soldiers' scouting parties to build fires for warmth. They did not wish to go far away to the Bosque, but would build hogans near Fort Wingate, where they would always be under the eyes of the soldiers as peaceful Indians. In 9 days, Delgadito and Barbancito would come with the 500. The chiefs would be willing to go to Santa Fe to see the Star Chief and sue for peace. Captain Rafael Chacon, commanding Fort Wingate, posted the compromise offer to General Carleton, who replied, "The Navajo Indians have no choice in the matter. They must come in and go to the Bosque Redondo or remain in their own country at war." Having no choice in the matter and burdened with women and children suffering from cold and starvation, Delgadito surrendered. Barbancito, El Sordo, and many of the warriors waited in the mountains to see what would happen to their people. Those who had surrendered were sent to the Bosque Redondo, but Carleton arranged for the first captives to be given special treatment, the best rations, the best shelters, on the journey and upon arrival at the Bosque. Forbidding, as was that barren plain on the Pecos, Delgadito was impressed by the kindness of his captors. When the Star Chief informed him that he could return to Fort Wingate with his family if he would persuade other Navajo leaders that life at the Bosque was better than starvation and freezing, Delgadito agreed to go. At the same time, the general ordered Kit Carson to invade Canyon de Chelly, destroy food and livestock, and kill or capture the Navajos in that last stronghold. In preparation for the Chelly campaign, Carson assembled a pack herd to carry supplies. But on December 13th, Barbancito and his warriors swooped down on the herd and ran the mules off to the canyon, where they could be used as a winter meat supply. Carson sent two detachments of soldiers in pursuit, but the Navajos divided into several small parties and escaped under cover of a heavy snowstorm. Lieutenant Donaciano Montoya's cavalrymen stumbled upon a small camp, charged it, drove the Navajos into a cedar brake, and captured 13 women and children. The lieutenant reported, "Indian was shot through the right side but succeeded in escaping through the tangled underwood. His son, a little boy of 10 years old and very intelligent for an Indian, was taken a short time afterwards and reported that his father died amongst the rocks in a neighboring arroyo." With no mules for packing supplies, Kit Carson now informed General Carleton that the Canyon de Chelly expedition would have to be delayed. The general promptly replied, "You will not delay the expedition on account of lack of transportation. You will have the men carry their blankets and, if necessary, 3 or 4 days' rations in haversacks." On January 6, 1864, the soldiers marched out of Fort Canby. Captain Albert Pfeiffer led a small force which was to enter the east end of Canyon de Chelly. Kit Carson led a larger force which was to enter the west end. 6 inches of snow lay on the ground, temperature was below freezing, and the marching was slow. A week later, Pfeiffer entered the canyon. From rims and ledges, hundreds of half-starved Navajos hurled stones, pieces of wood, and Spanish curses upon the heads of the soldiers. But they could not stop them. Pfeiffer's men destroyed hogans, food caches, and livestock. They killed 3 Navajos who came within range of their muskets, found 2 elderly Navajos frozen to death, and captured 19 women and children. Carson, meanwhile, had established a camp at the west end and was scouting the canyon from the rims. On January 12th, one of his patrols encountered a band of Navajos, killing 11 of them. 2 days later, the two commands linked up. The entire canyon had been traversed without a major fight. That evening, 3 Navajos approached the soldiers' camp under a truce flag. Their people were starving and freezing, they told Carson. They chose to surrender rather than die. "You have until tomorrow morning," Carson replied. "After that time, my soldiers will hunt you down." Next morning, 60 ragged and emaciated Navajos arrived at the camp and surrendered. Before returning to Fort Canby, Carson ordered complete destruction of Navajo properties within the canyon, including their fine peach orchards, more than 5,000 trees. The Navajos could forgive the rope thrower for fighting them as a soldier, for making prisoners of them, even for destroying their food supplies. But the one act they never forgave him for was cutting down their beloved peach trees. During the next few weeks, as news of the soldiers' entry into Canyon de Chelly spread through the hidden camps of the Navajos, the people lost heart. "We fought for that country because we did not want to lose it," Manuelito said afterward. We lost nearly everything. The American nation is too powerful for us to fight. When we had to fight for a few days, we felt fresh, but in a short time we were worn out and the soldiers starved us out. On January 31st, Delgadito, with his reassurances of conditions at Bosque Redondo, persuaded 680 more Navajos to surrender at Fort Wingate. Severe winter weather and lack of food forced others to come into Fort Canby. By mid-February, 1,200 were there, hungry and destitute. The army issued them scanty rations, and the very old and the very young began to die. On February 21st, Herrero Grande came in with his band, and the numbers rose to 1,500. By early March, 3,000 had surrendered at both forts, and the trails to the north were filled with fearful Navajos approaching over the frozen snow. But the Rico chiefs, Manuelito, Barbancito, and Armijo, refused to quit. With their people, they stayed in the mountains, still determined not to surrender. During March, the long walk of the Navajos to Fort Sumner and the Bosque Redondo was set in motion. The first contingent of 1,430 reached Fort Sumner on March 13th. 10 died en route. 3 children were kidnapped, probably by Mexicans, among the soldier escort. Meanwhile, a second group of 2,400 had left Fort Canby, their numbers already reduced by 126 who had died at the fort. The long caravan included 30 wagons, 3,000 sheep, and 473 horses. The Navajos had the fortitude to bear freezing weather, hunger, dysentery, jeers of the soldiers, and the hard 300-mile journey. But they could not bear the homesickness, the loss of their land. They wept, and 197 of them died before they reached their cruel destination. On March 20th, 800 more Navajos left Fort Canby, most of them women, children, and old men. The army supplied them only 23 wagons. On the second day's march, the officer in command reported, a very severe snowstorm set in which lasted for 4 days with unusual severity, and occasioned great suffering amongst the Indians, many of whom were nearly naked and, of course, unable to withstand such a storm. When they reached Los Pinos, below Albuquerque, the army commandeered the wagons for other use, and the Navajos had to camp in the open. By the time the journey could be resumed, several children had vanished. At this place, a lieutenant commented, officers who have Indians in charge will have to exercise extreme vigilance, or the Indians' children will be stolen from them and sold. This contingent reached the Bosque on May 11, 1864. I left Fort Canby with 800 and received 146 en route to Fort Sumner, making about 946 in all. Of this number, about 110 died. Late in April, one of the holdout chiefs, Armijo, appeared at Fort Canby and informed the post commander, Captain Asa Carey, that Manuelito would arrive in a few days with Navajos who had spent the winter far to the north along the Little Colorado and San Juan. Armijo's band of more than 400 came in a few days later, but Manuelito halted his people a few miles away at a place called Quilitas and sent a messenger to inform the soldier chief that he would like to have a talk with him. During the parley which followed, Manuelito said that his people wished to stay near the fort, plant their grain crops, and graze their sheep as they had always done. There is but one place for you, Captain Carey replied, and that is to go to the Bosque. Why must we go to the Bosque? Manuelito asked. We have never stolen or murdered and have at all times kept the peace we promised General Canby. He added that his people feared they were being collected at the Bosque so the soldiers could shoot them down as they had at Fort Fauntleroy in 1861. Carey assured him that this was not so, but Manuelito said he would not surrender his people until he had talked with his old friend Herrero Grande or some of the other Navajo leaders who had been at the Bosque. When General Carleton heard that there was a chance of Manuelito surrendering, he sent 4 carefully chosen Navajos from the Bosque, but not Herrero Grande, to use their influence on the reluctant war chief. They did not convince Manuelito. One June night after they had talked, Manuelito and his band vanished from Quilitas and went back to their hiding places along the Little Colorado. In September, he heard that his old ally Barbancito had been captured in the Canyon de Chelly. Now he, Manuelito, was the last of the Rico holdouts, and he knew the soldiers would be looking everywhere for him. During the autumn, Navajos who had escaped from the Bosque Redondo began returning to their homeland with frightening accounts of what was happening to the people there. It was a wretched land, they said. The soldiers prodded them with bayonets and herded them into adobe-walled compounds where the soldier chiefs were always counting them and putting numbers down in little books. The soldier chiefs promised them clothing and blankets and better food, but their promises were never kept. All the cottonwood and mesquite had been cut down, so that only roots were left for firewood. To shelter themselves from rain and sun, they had to dig holes in the sandy ground and cover and line them with mats of woven grass. They lived like prairie dogs in burrows. With the few tools the soldiers gave them, they broke the soil of the Pecos bottomlands and planted grain, but floods and droughts and insects killed the crops, and now everyone was on half rations. Crowded together as they were, disease had begun to take a toll on the weaker ones. It was a bad place, and although escape was difficult and dangerous under the watchful eyes of the soldiers, many were risking their lives to get away. Meanwhile, Star Chief Carlton had persuaded the Vicario of Santa Fe to sing a Te Deum in celebration of the army's successful removal of the Navajos to the Bosque. And the general described the place to his superiors in Washington as a fine reservation. There is no reason why they, the Navajos, will not be the most happy and prosperous and well-provided-for Indians in the United States. At all events, we can feed them cheaper than we can fight them. In the eyes of the Star Chief, his prisoners were only mouths and bodies. These 6,000 mouths must eat, and these 6,000 bodies must be clothed. When it is considered what a magnificent pastoral and mineral country they have surrendered to us, a country whose value can hardly be estimated, the mere pittance in comparison, which must at once be given to support them, sinks into insignificance as a price for their natural heritage. And no advocate of manifest destiny ever phrased his support of that philosophy more unctuously than he. The exodus of this whole people from the land of their fathers is not only an interesting but a touching sight. They have fought us gallantly for years on years. They have defended their mountains and their stupendous canyons with a heroism which any people might be proud to emulate. But when, at length, they found it was their destiny, too, as it had been that of their brethren, tribe after tribe, away back toward the rising of the sun, to give way to the insatiable progress of our race, they threw down their arms, and, as brave men entitled to our admiration and respect, have come to us with confidence in our magnanimity, and feeling that we are too powerful and too just a people to repay that confidence with meanness or neglect, feeling that having sacrificed to us their beautiful country, their homes, the associations of their lives, the scenes rendered classic in their traditions, we will not dole out to them a miser's pittance in return for what they know to be, and what we know to be, a princely realm. Manuelito had not thrown down his arms, however, and he was too important a chief for General Carlton to permit such incorrigibility to continue unchallenged. In February 1865, Navajo runners from Fort Wingate brought Manuelito a message from the Star Chief, a warning that he and his band would be hunted down to the death unless they came in peaceably before spring. "I am doing no harm to anyone," Manuelito told the messengers. "I will not leave my country. I intend to die here." But he finally agreed to talk again with some of the chiefs who were at the Bosque Redondo. In late February, Herrero Grande and five other Navajo leaders from the Bosque arranged to meet Manuelito near the Zuni trading post. The weather was cold, and the land was covered with deep snow. After embracing his old friends, Manuelito led them back into the hills where his people were hidden. Only about 100 men, women, and children were left of Manuelito's band. They had a few horses and a few sheep. "Here is all I have in the world," Manuelito said. "See what a trifling amount. You see how poor they are. My children are eating pomillo roots." After a pause, he added that his horses were in no condition for travel to the Bosque. Herrero replied that he had no authority to extend the time set for him to surrender, and he warned Manuelito in a friendly way that he would be risking the lives of his people if he did not come in and surrender. Manuelito wavered. He said he would surrender for the sake of the women and children. Then he added that he would need 3 months to get his livestock in order. Finally, he declared flatly that he could not leave his country. "My God and my mother live in the West, and I will not leave them. It is a tradition of my people that we must never cross the three rivers, the Grand, the San Juan, the Colorado. Nor could I leave the Chaska Mountains. I was born there. I shall remain. I have nothing to lose but my life, and that they can come and take whenever they please, but I will not move. I have never done any wrong to the Americans or the Mexicans. I have never robbed. If I am killed, innocent blood will be shed." Herrero said to him, "I have done all I could for your benefit, have given you the best advice. I now leave you as if your grave were already made." In Santa Fe a few days later, Herrero Grande informed General Carleton of Manuelito's defiant stand. Carleton's response was a harsh order to the commander at Fort Wingate. "I understand if Manuelito could be captured, his band would doubtless come in, that if you could make certain arrangements with the Indians at the Zuni village, where he frequently comes on a visit and to trade, they would cooperate with you in his capture. Try hard to get Manuelito. Have him securely ironed and carefully guarded. It will be a mercy to others whom he controls to capture or kill him at once. I prefer he should be captured. If he attempts to escape, he will be shot down." But Manuelito was too clever to fall into Carleton's trap at Zuni, and he managed to avoid capture through the spring and summer of 1865. Late in the summer, Barbancito and several of his warriors escaped from Bosque Redondo. They were said to be in the Apache country of Sierra del Escadillo. So many Navajos were slipping away from the reservation that Carleton posted permanent guards for 40 miles around Fort Sumner. In August, the general ordered the post commander to kill every Navajo found off the reservation without a pass. When the Basque's grain crops failed again in the autumn of 1865, the army issued the Navajos meal, flour, and bacon, which had been condemned as unfit for soldiers to eat. Deaths began to rise again, and so did the number of attempted escapes. Although General Carleton was being openly criticized now by New Mexicans for conditions at Bosque Redondo, he continued to hunt down Navajos. At last, on September 1, 1866, the chief he wanted most, Manuelito, limped into Fort Wingate with 23 beaten warriors and surrendered. They were all in rags, their bodies emaciated. They still wore leather bands on their wrists for protection from the slaps of bowstrings, but they had no war bows, no arrows. One of Manuelito's arms hung useless at his side from a wound. A short time later, Barbancito came in with 21 followers and surrendered for the second time. Now there were no more war chiefs. Ironically, only 18 days after Manuelito surrendered, General Carleton was removed from command of the Army's Department of New Mexico. The Civil War, which had brought Star Chief Carleton to power, had been over for more than a year, and the New Mexicans had had enough of him and his pompous ways. When Manuelito arrived at the Bosque, a new superintendent was there, A.B. Norton. The superintendent examined the soil on the reservation and pronounced it unfit for cultivation of grain because of the presence of alkali. "The water is black and brackish, scarcely bearable to the taste, and said by the Indians to be unhealthy because one-fourth of their population have been swept off by disease." The reservation, Norton added, had cost the government millions of dollars. "The sooner it is abandoned and the Indians removed, the better. I have heard it suggested that there was speculation at the bottom of it. Do you expect an Indian to be satisfied and contented, deprived of the common comforts of life, without which a white man would not be contented anywhere? Would any sensible man select a spot for a reservation for 8,000 Indians, where the water is scarcely bearable, where the soil is poor and cold, and where the mesquite roots, 12 miles distant, are the only wood for the Indians to use? If they remain on this reservation, they must always be held there by force and not from choice. Oh, let them go back, or take them to where they can have good cool water to drink, wood plenty to keep them from freezing to death, and where the soil will produce something for them to eat." For 2 years, a steady stream of investigators and officials from Washington paraded through the reservation. Some were genuinely compassionate, some were mainly concerned with reducing expenditures. "We were there for a few years," Manuelito remembered. "Many of our people died from the climate. People from Washington held a council with us. He explained how the whites punished those who disobeyed the law. We promised to obey the laws if we were permitted to get back to our own country. We promised to keep the treaty. We promised 4 times to do so. We all said yes to the treaty, and he gave us good advice. He was General Sherman." When the Navajo leaders first saw the great warrior Sherman, they were fearful of him because his face was the same as Star Chief Carlton's, fierce and hairy with a cruel mouth. But his eyes were different, the eyes of a man who had suffered and knew the pain of it in others. "We told him we would try to remember what he said," Manuelito recalled. "He said, 'I want all you people to look at me.' He stood up for us to see him. He said if we would do right, we could look people in the face. Then he said, 'My children, I will send you back to your homes.'" Before they could leave, the chiefs had to sign the new treaty, June 1, 1868, which began, "From this day forward, all war between the parties to this agreement shall forever cease." Barbancito signed first, then Armijo, Delgadito, Manuelito, Herrero Grande, and seven others. "The nights and days were long before it came time for us to go to our homes," Manuelito said. "The day before we were to start, we went a little way towards home because we were so anxious to start. We came back, and the Americans gave us a little stock, and we thanked them for that. We told the drivers to whip the mules, we were in such a hurry. When we saw the top of the mountain from Albuquerque, we wondered if it was our mountain, and we felt like talking to the ground. We loved it so. And some of the old men and women cried with joy when they reached their homes." And so the Navajos came home. When the new reservation lines were surveyed, much of their best pasture land was taken away for the white settlers. Life would not be easy. They would have to struggle to endure. Bad as it was, the Navajos would come to know that they were the least unfortunate of all the Western Indians. For the others, the ordeal had hardly begun. Chapter 3. Little Crow's War. 1862. April 6th. General Grant defeats Confederates in Battle of Shiloh. May 6th. Henry D. Thoreau dies at age 45. May 20th. Congress passes Homestead Act, granting 160 acres of western land to settlers at $1.25 per acre. July 2nd. Congress passes Morrill Act for creation of land-grant colleges. July 10th, construction of Central Pacific Railroad begins. August 30th, Union Army defeated in Second Battle of Bull Run. September 17th, Confederate Army defeated at Antietam. September 22nd, Lincoln declares all slaves free from January 1, 1863. October 13th, in Germany, Bismarck delivers Blood and Iron speech. December 13th, Union Army suffers severe losses and defeat at Fredericksburg. Nation plunged into gloom. Some army units near mutiny as they go into winter quarters. December 29th, General Sherman defeated at Chickasaw Bayou. Victor Hugo's Les Misérables and Turgenev's Fathers and Sons published. 1863, April 2nd, bread riot in Richmond, Virginia. May 2nd to 4th, Confederates win victory at Chancellorsville. July 1st to 3rd, Union Army defeats Confederates at Gettysburg. July 4th, Vicksburg falls to Grant's army. July 11th, drafting of soldiers for Union Army begins. July 13th to 17th, several hundred lives lost in New York City draft riots. Other riots occur in many cities. July 15th, President Davis orders first conscriptions for Confederate service. September 5th, bread riots in Mobile. Value of Confederate dollar drops to 8 cents. October 1st, five Russian war vessels enter Port of New York and are warmly received. November 24th to 25th, Confederates defeated at Chattanooga. December 8th, President Lincoln offers amnesty to Confederates willing to return allegiance to the Union. The whites were always trying to make the Indians give up their life and live like white men, go to farming, work hard, and do as they did. And the Indians did not know how to do that and did not want to anyway. If the Indians had tried to make the whites live like them, the whites would have resisted, and it was the same way with many Indians. Wamdatanka, Big Eagle, of the Santee Sioux. Almost 1,000 miles north of the Navajo country, and at this same time of the white men's great civil war, the Santee Sioux were losing their homeland forever. The Santees were of four divisions, the Medicanatans, Wapitans, Wapakutes, and Sisitans. They were woodland Sioux, but kept close ties and shared a strong tribal pride with their blood brothers of the prairies, the Yanktans and the Tetons. The Santees were the people of the farther end, the frontier guardians of the Sioux domain. During the 10 years preceding the Civil War, more than 150,000 white settlers pushed into Santee country, thus collapsing the left flank of the once permanent Indian frontier. As the result of two deceptive treaties, the Woodland Sioux surrendered 9/10 of their land and were crowded into a narrow strip of territory along the Minnesota River. From the beginning, agents and traders had hovered around them like buzzards around the carcasses of slaughtered buffalo, systematically cheating them out of the greater part of the promised annuities for which they had been persuaded to give up their lands. Many of the white men often abused the Indians and treated them unkindly, Big Eagle said. Perhaps they had excuse, but the Indians did not think so. Many of the whites always seemed to say by their manner when they saw an Indian, "I am better than you," and the Indians did not like this. There was excuse for this, but the Dakotas, Sioux, did not believe there were better men in the world than they. Then some of the white men abused the Indian women in a certain way and disgraced them, and surely there was no excuse for that. All these things made many Indians dislike the whites. In the summer of 1862, everything seemed to go badly between the Santees and the white men. Most of the wild game was gone from the reservation land, and when the Indians crossed into their old hunting grounds now claimed by white settlers, there was often trouble. For the second year running, the Indians' crop yields were poor, and many of them had to go to the agency traders to obtain food on credit. The Santees had learned to hate the credit system because they had no control over the accounts. When their annuities came from Washington, the traders held first claim on the money, and whatever amount the traders claimed in their accounts, government agents would pay them. Some of the Santees had learned to keep accounts, and although their records might be less by many dollars than the traders' accounts, the government agents would not accept them. Ta Oyateduta, Little Crow, became very angry with the traders during the summer of 1862. Little Crow was a chief of the Medicanatans, as had been his father and grandfather before him. He was 60 years old and always wore long-sleeved garments to cover his lower arms and wrists, which were withered as the result of badly healed wounds received in battle during his youth. Little Crow had signed both the treaties that tricked his people out of their land and the money promised for the land. He had been to Washington to see the Great Father, President Buchanan. He had exchanged his breech clouts and blankets for trousers and brass-buttoned jackets. He had joined the Episcopal Church, built a house, and started a farm. But during the summer of 1862, Little Crow's disillusionment was turning to anger. In July, several thousand Santees assembled at the upper agency on Yellow Medicine River to collect their annuities, which were pledged by the treaties, so that they might exchange them for food. The money did not arrive, and there were rumors that the Great Council, Congress, in Washington had expended all their gold fighting the Great Civil War and could not send any money to the Indians. Because their people were starving, Little Crow and some of the other chiefs went to their agent, Thomas Galbraith, and asked why they could not be issued food from the agency warehouse, which was filled with provisions. Galbraith replied that he could not do this until the money arrived, and he brought up 100 soldiers to guard the warehouse. On August 4th, 500 Santees surrounded the soldiers while others broke into the warehouse and began carrying out sacks of flour. The white soldier chief, Timothy Sheehan, sympathized with the Santees. Instead of firing upon them, he persuaded Agent Galbraith to issue pork and flour to the Indians and await payment until the money arrived. After Galbraith did this, the Santees went away peacefully. Little Crow did not leave, however, until the agent promised to issue similar amounts of food to the Santees at the lower agency, 30 miles downriver at Redwood. Although Little Crow's village was near the lower agency, Galbraith kept him waiting several days before arranging a council at Redwood for August 15th. Early that morning, Little Crow and several 100 hungry Medicanatans assembled, but it was obvious from the beginning that Galbraith and the 4 traders at the lower agency had no intention of issuing food from their stores before arrival of the annuity funds. Angered by yet another broken promise, Little Crow arose, faced Galbraith, and spoke for his people. "We have waited a long time. The money is ours, but we cannot get it. We have no food, but here are these stores filled with food. We ask that you, the agent, make some arrangement by which we can get food from the stores, or else we may take our own way to keep ourselves from starving. When men are hungry, they help themselves." Instead of replying, Galbraith turned to the traders and asked them what they would do. Trader Andrew Myrick declared contemptuously, So far as I am concerned, if they are hungry, let them eat grass or their own dung. For a moment the circle of Indians was silent. Then came an outburst of angry shouts, and as one man the Santees arose and left the council. The words of Andrew Myrick angered all the Santees, but to Little Crow they were like hot blasts upon his already seared emotions. For years he had tried to keep the treaties, to follow the advice of the white men and lead his people on their road. It seemed now that he had lost everything. His own people were losing faith in him, blaming him for their misfortunes. And now the agents and traders had turned against him. Earlier that summer, the lower agency Metacanotans had accused Little Crow of betraying them when he signed away their lands by treaties. They had elected Traveling Hale to be their speaker in place of Little Crow. If Little Crow could have persuaded Agent Galbraith and the traders to give his people food, they would have respected him again. But he had failed. In the old days, he could have regained leadership by going to war, but the treaties pledged him not to engage in hostilities with either the white men or other tribes. Why was it, he wondered, that the Americans talked so much of peace between themselves and the Indians, and between Indians and Indians, and yet they themselves waged such a savage war with the Greycoats that they had no money left to pay their small debts to the Santees? He knew that some of the young men in his band were talking openly of war with the white men, a war to drive them out of the Minnesota Valley. It was a good time to fight the whites, they said, because so many Bluecoat soldiers were away fighting the Greycoats. Little Crow considered such talk foolish. He had been to the east and seen the power of the Americans. They were everywhere like locusts and destroyed their enemies with great thundering cannon. War upon the white men was unthinkable. On Sunday, August 17th, Little Crow attended the Episcopal Church at the Lower Agency and listened to a sermon delivered by the Reverend Samuel Hinman. At the conclusion of services, he shook hands with the other worshippers and returned to his house, which was 2 miles upriver from the agency. Late that night, Little Crow was awakened by the sound of many voices and the noisy entry of several Santees into his sleeping room. He recognized the voice of Shakopee. Something very important, something very bad had happened. Shakopee, Mankato, Medicine Bottle, and Big Eagle all had come, and they said Wabasha would soon arrive for a council. 4 young men of Shakopee's band, who were hungry for food, had crossed the river that sunny afternoon to hunt in the big woods. And something very bad had happened there. Big Eagle told about it. They came to a settler's fence, and here they found a hen's nest with some eggs in it. One of them took the eggs, when another said, "Don't take them, for they belong to a white man, and we may get into trouble." The other was angry, for he was very hungry and wanted to eat the eggs, and he dashed them to the ground and replied, "You are a coward. You are afraid of the white man. You are afraid to take even an egg from him, though you are half-starved. Yes, you are a coward, and I will tell everybody so." The other replied, "I am not a coward. I am not afraid of the white man, and to show you that I am not, I will go to the house and shoot him. Are you brave enough to go with me?" The one who had called him coward said, "Yes, I will go with you, and we will see who is the braver of us two." Their 2 companions then said, "We will go with you, and we will be brave too." They all went to the house of the white man, but he got alarmed and went to another house where there were some other white men and women. The 4 Indians followed them and killed 3 men and 2 women. Then they hitched up a team belonging to another settler and drove to Shakopee's camp and told what they had done. On hearing of the murders of the white people, Little Crow rebuked the 4 young men, and then sarcastically asked Shakopee and the others why they had come to him for advice when they had chosen Traveling Hale to be their spokesman. The leaders assured Little Crow that he was still their war chief. No Santee's life would be safe now after these killings, they said. It was the white man's way to punish all Indians for the crimes of one or a few. The Santees might as well strike first instead of waiting for the soldiers to come and kill them. It would be better to fight the white men now while they were fighting among themselves far to the south. Little Crow rejected their arguments. The white men were too powerful, he said. Yet he admitted the settlers would exact bitter vengeance because women had been killed. Little Crow's son, who was present, said later that his father's face grew haggard and great beads of sweat stood out on his forehead. At last one of the young braves cried out, "Taoyatiduta, Little Crow, is a coward." Coward was the word that had started the killings, the challenge to the young boy who was afraid to take the white man's eggs even when he was starving. "Coward" was not a word that a Sioux chief could take lightly, even though he was halfway on the white man's road. Little Crow's reply, as remembered by his young son, "Ta'oyatiduta is not a coward, and he is not a fool. When did he run away from his enemies? When did he leave his braves behind him on the warpath and turn back to his teepee? When he ran away from your enemies, he walked behind on your trail with his face to the Ojibways and covered your backs as a she-bear covers her cubs. Is Ta'oyatiduta without scalps? Look at his war feathers. Behold the scalp locks of your enemies hanging there on his lodge poles. Do you call him a coward? Ta'oyatiduta is not a coward, and he is not a fool. Braves, you are like little children. You know not what you are doing. You are full of the white man's devil water. You are like dogs in the hot moon when they run mad and snap at their own shadows. We are only little herds of buffalo left scattered. The great herds that once covered the prairies are no more. See? The white men are like the locusts when they fly so thick that the whole sky is a snowstorm. You may kill 1, 2, 10, yes, as many as the leaves in the forest yonder, and their brothers will not miss them. Kill 1, 2, 10, and 10 times 10 will come to kill you. Count your fingers all day long, and white men with guns in their hands will come faster than you can count. Yes, they fight among themselves, away off. Do you hear the thunder of their big guns? No, it would take you 2 moons to run down to where they are fighting, and all the way your path would be among white soldiers as thick as tamaracks in the swamps of the Ojibways. Yes, they fight among themselves, but if you strike at them, they will all turn on you and devour you and your women and little children, just as the locusts in their time fall on the trees and devour all the leaves in one day. You are fools. You cannot see the face of your chief. Your eyes are full of smoke. You cannot hear his voice. Your ears are full of roaring waters. Braves, you are little children. You are fools. You will die like the rabbits when the hungry wolves hunt them in the hard moon of January. Ta'oyatiduta is not a coward. He will die with you. Big Eagle then spoke for peace, but he was shouted down. 10 years of abuse by white men, the broken treaties, the lost hunting grounds, the unkept promises, the undelivered annuities, their hunger for food while the agency warehouses overflowed with it, the insulting words of Andrew Myrick, all rose up to put the murders of the white settlers into the background. Little Crow sent messengers upstream to summon the Wahpetons and Sisseton to join in the war. The women were awakened and began to run bullets while the warriors cleaned their guns. Little Crow gave orders to attack the agency early next morning and to kill all the traders, Big Eagle said afterward. The next morning, when the force started to attack the agency, I went along. I did not lead my band, and I took no part in the killing. I went to save the lives of 2 particular friends, if I could. I think others went for the same reason, for nearly every Indian had a friend he did not want killed. Of course, he did not care about anybody else's friend. The killing was nearly all done when I got there. Little Crow was on the ground directing operations. Mr. Andrew Myrick, a trader with an Indian wife, had refused some hungry Indians credit a short time before when they asked him for some provisions. He said to them, "Go and eat grass." Now he was lying on the ground dead with his mouth stuffed full of grass, and the Indians were saying tauntingly, "Myrick is eating grass himself." The Santees killed 20 men, captured 10 women and children, emptied the warehouses of provisions, and set the other buildings afire. The remaining 47 inhabitants, some of whom were aided in their escapes by friendly Santees, fled across the river to Fort Ridgely, 13 miles downstream. On the way to Fort Ridgely, the survivors met a company of 45 soldiers marching to the aid of the agency. The Reverend Hinman, who the previous day had preached the last sermon ever heard by Little Crow, warned the soldiers to turn back. The soldier chief, John Marsh, refused to heed the warning, and marched into a Santee ambush. Only 24 of his men escaped alive to make their way back to the fort. Encouraged by his first successes, Little Crow decided to attack the soldier's house itself, Fort Ridgely. Wabasha and his band had arrived. Mankato's force had been increased by more warriors. Fresh allies were reported on their way from the upper agency, and Big Eagle could no longer remain neutral while his people were at war. During the night, these chiefs and their several 100 warriors moved down the Minnesota Valley, and early on the morning of August 19th began assembling on the prairie west of the fort. "The young men were all anxious to go," said Lightning Blanket, one of the participants. "And we dressed as warriors in war paint, breech clouts, and leggings, with a large sash around us to keep our food and ammunition in." When some of the untried young men saw the sturdy stone buildings of the soldiers' house and the armed bluecoats waiting there, they had second thoughts about attacking the place. On the way down from the lower agency, they had talked of how easy it would be to raid the village on the Cottonwood, New Ulm. The town across the river was filled with stores to be looted, and no soldiers were there. Why could they not do their fighting at New Ulm? Little Crow told them the Santees were at war, and to be victorious they must defeat the Bluecoat soldiers. If they could drive the soldiers from the valley, then all the white settlers would go away. The Santees could gain nothing by killing a few white people at New Ulm. But in spite of Little Crow's scoldings and entreaties, the young men began to drift away toward the river. Little Crow consulted with the other chiefs, and they decided to delay the assault on Fort Ridgely until the next day. That evening, the young men returned from New Ulm. They had frightened the people there, they said, but the town was too strongly defended, and besides, a bad lightning storm came out of the sky in the afternoon. Big Eagle called them marauding Indians, without a chief to lead them, and that night they all agreed to stay together and attack Fort Ridgely the following morning. "We started at sunrise," Lightning Blanket said, "and crossed the river at the agency on the ferry, following the road to the top of the hill below Fairbow's Creek, where we stopped for a short rest. There the plans for attacking the fort were given out by Little Crow." After reaching the fort, the signal, three volleys, was to be given by Medicine Bottle's men to draw the attention and fire of the soldiers, so the men on the east, Big Eagles, and those on the west and south, Little Crows and Shakopees, could rush in and take the fort. We reached the 3 Mile Creek before noon and cooked something to eat. After eating, we separated, I going with the footmen to the north, and after leaving Little Crow, we paid no attention to the chiefs. Everyone did as he pleased. Both parties reached the fort about the same time, as we could see them passing to the west, Little Crow on a black pony. The signal, three shots, was given by our side, Medicine Bottle's men. After the signal, the men on the east, south, and west were slow in coming up. While shooting, we ran up to the building near the big stone one. As we were running in, we saw the man with the big guns, whom we all knew. And as we were the only ones in sight, he shot into us, as he had gotten ready after hearing the shooting in our direction. Had Little Crow's men fired after we fired the signal, the soldiers who shot at us would have been killed. Two of our men were killed and three hurt, two dying afterward. We ran back into the creek and did not know whether the other men would come up close or not, but they did, and the big guns drove them back from that direction. If we had known that they would come up close, we could have shot at the same time and killed all, as the soldiers were out in the big opening between the buildings. We did not fight like white men with one officer. We all shot as we pleased. The plan of rushing into the buildings was given up, and we shot at the windows, mostly at the big stone building, as we thought many of the whites were in there. We could not see them, so we're not sure we were killing any. During the shooting, we tried to set fire to the buildings with fire arrows, but the buildings would not burn, so we had to get more powder and bullets. The sun was about 2 hours high when we went around to the west of the fort and decided to go back to Little Crow's village and come and keep up the fighting next day. There were about 400 Indians in this attack. No women were along. They all stayed at Little Crow's village. The cooking was done by boys 10 to 15 years of age, too young to fight. That evening in the village, both Little Crow and Big Eagle were low in spirits because they had not been able to take the soldiers' house. Big Eagle opposed another attack. The Santees did not have enough warriors to storm the soldiers' big guns, he said. They would lose too many men if they made another attack. Little Crow said he would decide later what to do. Meanwhile, everyone should go to work making as many bullets as possible. There was plenty of gunpowder left from the agency storehouse. Later in the evening, the situation changed. 400 Wahpeton and Sisseton warriors came in from the upper agency and offered to join the Medicanottans in their war against the white men. Little Crow was elated. The Santee Sioux were united again, 800 strong, surely enough warriors to take Fort Ridgely. He called a war council and issued strict orders for the next day's fighting. This time they must not fail. Early on August 22nd, we started, Lightning Blanket said. But the grass was wet with dew, more than on the day of the first attack, so the sun was quite high before we traveled very far, and it was just before the middle of the day when we reached the fort. We did not stop to eat this time, but each carried something to eat in his legging sash and ate it in the middle of the day while fighting. Big Eagle said the second fight at Fort Ridgely was a grand affair. We went down determined to take the fort, for we knew it was of the greatest importance to us to have it. If we could take it, we would soon have the whole Minnesota Valley. This time, instead of approaching the fort boldly, the Santee warriors fastened prairie grass and flowers to their headbands as a means of concealment, and then crept up the gullies and crawled through the brush until they were close enough to fire upon the defenders. A shower of blazing arrows set roofs afire. Then the Santees rushed the stables. In this fight, said Wakante Amane, I came up on the south side to the stables and tried to get a horse. As I was leading it out, a shell burst in the stable near me, and the horse sprang over me and got away, knocking me down. When I got up, I saw a mule running, and I was so mad I shot it. For a few minutes there was hand-to-hand fighting around the stables, but again the Santees had to give way before fierce blasts of the soldiers' artillery. Little Crow was wounded, not seriously, but the loss of blood weakened him. When he withdrew from the field to regain his strength, Mankato led another assault. Double charges of canister shot cut down the rushing warriors, and the attack failed. But for the cannon, I think we would have taken the fort, Big Eagle said. The soldiers fought us so bravely we thought there were more of them than there were. About 150 soldiers and 25 armed civilians defended Fort Ridgely on August 22nd. Big Eagle lost the most men in the fighting that day. Late in the afternoon, the Santee leaders called off the attack. The sun was now setting low, Lightning Blanket said, and after we saw the men on the south and west driven back by the big guns, and could see Little Crow and his men going to the northwest, we decided to join them and see what to do. After joining them, we supposed we were going back to Little Crow's village for more warriors. Little Crow told us there were no more warriors, and a discussion followed. Some wanted to renew the attack on the fort the next morning and then go to New Ulm. Others wanted to attack New Ulm early the next morning and then come back and take the fort. We were afraid the soldiers would get to New Ulm first. The soldiers that Lightning Blanket referred to were 1,400 men of the 6th Minnesota Regiment approaching from St. Paul. They were led by a soldier chief quite well known to the Santee Sioux. He was the Long Trader, Colonel Henry H. Sibley. Of the $475,000 promised the Santees in their first treaty, Long Trader Sibley had claimed $145,000 for his American Fur Company as money due for overpayments to the Santees. The Santees believed the Fur Company had underpaid them, but their agent, Alexander Ramsey, had accepted Sibley's claim, as well as the claims of other traders, so that the Santees received practically nothing for their lands. Ramsey was now the governor of Minnesota, and he had appointed the Long Trader to be the Eagle Chief of the Minnesota Regiment. At mid-morning of August 23rd, the Santees attacked New Ulm. They streamed out of the woods in bright sunlight, formed an arc across the prairie, and swept toward the town. The citizens of New Ulm were ready for them. After the abortive attack by the young braves on August 19th, the townspeople had built barricades, brought in more weapons, and secured the help of militia from towns down the valley. When the Santees came within a mile and a half of the forward line of white defenders, the mass of warriors began spreading like a fan. At the same time, they increased their speed and began yelling war cries to frighten the white men. Mankato was the war leader on this day. Little Crow lay wounded in his village, and his plan of attack was to envelop the town. The firing on both sides was sharp and rapid, but the onrush of Indians was slowed by the citizens, who used loopholed buildings for defensive positions. Early in the afternoon, the Santees set fire to several structures on the windward side of New Ulm in expectation of advancing under a smoke screen. 60 warriors, mounted and on foot, charged a barricade, but were driven back by heavy volleys. It was a long and bitter battle, fought in the streets, dwellings, outhouses, and store buildings. When darkness fell, the Santees departed without a victory, but they left behind them the smoldering ruins of 190 buildings and more than 100 casualties among the stubborn defenders of New Ulm. 3 days later, the advance column of Long Trader Sibley's regiment reached Fort Ridgely, and the Santees began withdrawing up the Minnesota Valley. They had with them more than 200 prisoners, mostly white women and children, and a considerable number of half-breeds known to be sympathetic toward the whites. After establishing a temporary village about 40 miles above the upper agency, Little Crow began negotiating with other Sioux leaders in the area, hoping to gain their support. He had little success. One reason for their lack of enthusiasm was Little Crow's failure to drive the soldiers from Fort Ridgely. Another reason was the indiscriminate killing of white settlers on the north side of the Minnesota River, a bloody slaughter carried out by marauding bands of undisciplined young men while Little Crow was besieging Fort Ridgely. Several hundred settlers had been trapped in their cabins without warning. Many had been brutally slain. Others had fled to safety, some to the villages of the Sioux bands that Little Crow hoped would join his cause. Although Little Crow was contemptuous of those who made war on defenseless settlers, he knew that his decision to begin the war had unleashed the raiders. But it was too late to turn back. The war against the soldiers would go on as long as he had warriors to fight them. On September 1st, he decided to make a scout downriver to test the strength of Long Trader Sibley's army. The Santees divided into two forces, Little Crow leading 110 warriors along the north side of the Minnesota, while Big Eagle and Mankato scouted the south bank with a larger force. Little Crow's plan was to avoid a frontal meeting with the soldiers and instead slip around to the rear of Sibley's lines and try to capture the army's supply train. To do this, he made a wide swing to the north, bringing his warriors close to several settlements which had withstood attacks from marauders during the previous 2 weeks. The temptation to raid some of the smaller settlements brought on dissension among Little Crow's followers. On the second day of the reconnaissance, one of the sub-chiefs called a war council and proposed that they attack the settlements for plunder. Little Crow was opposed. Their enemies were the soldiers, he insisted. They must fight the soldiers. At the end of the council, 75 warriors joined the sub-chief for plundering. Only 35 loyal followers remained with Little Crow. On the following morning, Little Crow's small party unexpectedly met a company of 75 soldiers. During the running battle which followed, the sound of musketry brought the defecting Santees of the previous day rushing back to Little Crow's rescue. In bloody, close-in fighting, the soldiers used their bayonets, but the Santees killed 6 and wounded 15 of their enemy before the latter escaped in a hasty retreat to Hutchinson. For the next 2 days, the Santees reconnoitered around Hutchinson and Forest City, but the soldiers remained within stockades. On September 5th, runners brought news of a battle a few miles to the southwest. Big Eagle and Mankato had trapped the Long Trader's soldiers at Birch Coulee. During the night before the battle at Birch Coulee, Big Eagle and Mankato had quietly surrounded the soldiers' camp so they could not escape. "Just at dawn, the fight began," Big Eagle said. "It continued all day and the following night until late the next morning. Both sides fought well. Owing to the white men's way of fighting, they lost many men. Owing to the Indians' way of fighting, they lost but few. About the middle of the afternoon, our men became much dissatisfied at the slowness of the fight and the stubbornness of the whites, and the word was passed around the lines to get ready to charge the camp. The brave Mankato wanted to charge after the first hour. Just as we were about to charge, word came that a large number of mounted soldiers were coming up from the east toward Fort Ridgely. This stopped the charge and created some excitement. Mankato at once took some men from the coulee and went out to meet them. Mankato flourished his men around so, and all the Indians in the coulee kept up a noise, and at last the whites began to fall back, and they retreated about 2 miles and began to dig breastworks. Mankato followed them and left about 30 men to watch them, and returned to the fight at the coulee with the rest. The Indians were laughing when they came back at the way they had deceived the white men, and we were all glad that the whites had not pushed forward and driven us away. The next morning, General Sibley came with a very large force and drove us away from the field. We took our time getting away. Some of our men said they remained till Sibley got up, and that they fired at some of his men as they were shaking hands with some of the men of the camp. Those of us who were on the prairie went back to the westward and on down the valley. There was no pursuit. The whites fired their cannons at us as we were leaving the field, but they might as well have beaten a big drum for all the harm they did. They only made a noise. We went back across the river to our camps in the old village, and then on up the river to the Yellow Medicine at the mouth of the Chippewa. where Little Crow joined us. At last the word came that Sibley, with his army, was again on the move against us. He had left a letter for Little Crow in a split stick on the battlefield of Birch Coulee, and some of our men found it and brought it in. The message left by the Long Trader was brief and non-committal. If Little Crow has any proposition to make, let him send a half-breed to me, and he shall be protected in and out of camp. H. H. Sibley, Colonel, Command, Military Expedition. Little Crow, of course, did not trust this man who was sharp enough to get away with so much of the Santee's treaty money, but he decided to send a reply. He thought that perhaps the Long Trader, who had been up at the White Rock, St. Paul, did not know why the Santees had gone to war. Little Crow also wanted Governor Ramsey to know the reasons for the war. Many of the neutrals among the Santees were frightened at what Ramsey had told the white Minnesotans. The Sioux Indians must be exterminated or driven forever beyond the borders of the state. Little Crow's message of September 7th to General Sibley. For what reason we have commenced this war, I will tell you. It is on account of Major Galbraith. We made a treaty with the government, and beg for what we do get, and can't get that till our children are dying with hunger. It is the traitors who commenced it. Mr. A.J. Myrick told the Indians that they would eat grass or dirt. Then Mr. Forbes told the Lower Sioux that they were not men. Then Roberts was working with his friends to defraud us out of our monies. Thomas J. Galbraith was the reservation agent. A.J. Myrick, William Forbes, and Lewis Roberts were post-traders at the lower agency. If the young braves have pushed the white men, I have done this myself. So I want you to let Governor Ramsey know this. I have a great many prisoners, women and children. I want you to give me an answer to the bearer. General Sibley's reply. Little Crow, you have murdered many of our people without any sufficient cause. Return me the prisoners under a flag of truce, and I will talk with you then like a man. Little Crow had no intention of returning the prisoners before the Long Trader gave some indication of whether he meant to carry out Governor Ramsey's dictum of extermination or exile for the Santees. He wanted to use the prisoners for bargaining. In the councils of the various bands, however, there was much disagreement over what course the Santees should take before Sibley's army reached the Yellow Medicine. Paul Mazakutamane of the upper agency Sisseton's condemned Little Crow for starting the war. "Give me all these white captives," he demanded. "I will deliver them up to their friends. Stop fighting. No one who fights with the white people ever becomes rich or remains 2 days in one place, but is always fleeing and starving." Wabasha, who had been in the battles at Fort Ridgely and New Ulm, was also in favor of opening a road to peace by freeing the prisoners, but his son-in-law, Radai Nyanka, spoke for Little Crow and the majority of the warriors. "I am for continuing the war and am opposed to the delivery of the prisoners. I have no confidence that the whites will stand by any agreement they make if we give them up. Ever since we treated with them, their agents and traders have robbed and cheated us. Some of our people have been shot, some hung, others placed upon floating ice and drowned, and many have been starved in their prisons. It was not the intention of the nation to kill any of the whites until after the four men returned from Acton and told what they had done. When they did this, all the young men became excited and commenced the massacre. The older ones would have prevented it if they could, but since the treaties, they have lost all their influence. We may regret what has happened, but the matter has gone too far to be remedied. We have got to die. Let us then kill as many of the whites as possible, and let the prisoners die with us." On September 12th, Little Crow gave the Long Trader one last chance to end the war without further bloodshed. In his message, he assured Sibley that the prisoners were being treated kindly. "I want to know from you as a friend," he added, "what way that I can make peace for my people." Unknown to Little Crow, on that same day, Wabasha sent Sibley a secret message, blaming Little Crow for starting the war and claiming that he, Wabasha, was a friend of the good white people. He did not mention that he had fought them a few weeks earlier at Fort Ridgely and New Ulm. "I have been kept back by threats that I should be killed if I did anything to help the whites," he declared. "But if you will now appoint some place for me to meet you, myself and the few friends that I have will get all the prisoners we can, and with our family go to whatever place you will appoint for us to meet." Sibley answered both messages immediately. He scolded Little Crow for not giving up the prisoners, telling him that was not the way to make peace, but he did not answer the war leader's plea for a way to end the fighting. Instead, Sibley wrote a long letter to Little Crow's betrayer, Wabasha, giving him explicit instructions for using a truce flag for delivery of the prisoners. "I shall be glad to receive all true friends of the whites," Sibley promised, "with as many prisoners as they can bring, and I am powerful enough to crush all who attempt to oppose my march, and to punish those who have washed their hands